Thanks for tuning in to another installment of Advanced TV Herstory, a podcast that studies, analyzes, and celebrates women in television. Among thousands of comedies, variety shows, and dramas that have aired, the presence of strong women, both in front of and behind the camera, hold valuable lessons. In some cases, good shows or characters of today can be traced to an influence that aired 20, 30, even 40 years ago. With an eye to aligning the leadership lesson, time capsule observation, or fascinating backstory of a show's success or failure, my goal of Advanced TV Herstory is to connect the treasures of the past to the great potential of today's TV and online platforms. Theme songs that prompt a smile, characters that make you want to stand a little taller, shows that defy social norms or expectations of how women should behave, it's all here in Advanced TV Herstory. I'm your host, Cynthia Bemis Abrams. This installment of Advanced TV Herstory provides you a fascinating look into a short-lived series from the mid-1990s that focused on teenagers. In the context of generations, the young people who comprised the core group of the show My So-Called Life were the first millennials or the last Gen Xers. It's a bit of a time capsule of what teen years were like before cell phones and the internet. My So-Called Life, which has a bit of a cult following, was a drama set in Pittsburgh that focused on the lives of a group of sophomores from Liberty High School. Advanced TV historians will appreciate My So-Called Life for a few reasons. The main string of relationships featured in the 19 episodes that aired focuses on daughters and their moms. The main character is one of those daughters, a 14-year-old Claire Danes, who walked away with a few trophies for her portrayal of Angela Chase. Another reason to value this show is the depth of the storytelling. There's no condescension in addressing the earthly crises of coming of age. And in fact, the writers create numerous parallels between the young women and their mothers, as all confront emotional or ethical dilemmas. In its very brief life, this show tackled weighty issues and examined universal questions that all families experience. And then finally, we all need to know exactly what producer, writer, and actress Winnie Holtzman really has brought to TV in her career. In addition to her work on My So-Called Life, we'll take a look at her influence on the storylines of other shows, primarily those from the 90s and early 2000s. She's a very prolific writer and an active storyteller. In the following clip from a Paley Center interview, Claire Danes and Bess Armstrong discuss the mother-daughter vanity involved in the episode entitled Zit.
Episode called The Zit, which was about vanity, and but not really. It was about self-image and self-respect, and that I really related to. I think maybe because partly being in this business, looks are important, but it's just, that's been really hard for me. So that, I just love the way that was written.
I agree. I think that was, I mean, I loved every single script, but I think that one stands out as my absolute favorite, because it drew the parallel so beautifully between the angst of being 15 years old and the angst of being 40 years old, and that maybe the difference is a zit and lines, but the insecurity is the same. And I think that, you know, we've often said that if you tried to sum up the theme of the show in one sentence, it could be, you know, no matter how much we all change, we all remain the same.
So quick, grab that plaid flannel shirt, or if you identify more with the mother figures, grab your favorite pair of high-waisted pleated pants, and let's get into storytelling 90s style. From the very first episode, viewers know through narration that the show is seen through the eyes of Angela Chase and told largely in her voice. Danes delivers her narration in a deliberate and paced tone, turning sentences into rhetorical questions and observations into priceless teen philosophy.
People always say how you should be yourself, like, yourself is this definite thing, like a toaster or something. Like you can know what it is, even. But every so often, I'll have, like, a moment. When just being myself in my life, right where I am, is, like, enough.
On the continuum of high school girl personality styles, Angela Chase is fairly middle class, bright, stable, and cautious. She's the center to the other two young women, Rayanne Graff, played by A.J. Langer, on the less stable side, and Sharon Chersky, portrayed by Devin Odessa, on the more traditional end. Sharon and Angela have been friends their whole lives, as their mothers attended high school and college together, while Rayanne is new to Angela's social circle. And in a parallel construction, Angela's mother, Patty, played by a phenomenal Bess Armstrong, is at the center of the mom spectrum. Patty has taken over the family printing business from her father and works long hours and wears pleated pants. Her old friend Camille, played by the very warm Mary Kay Place, is married with one daughter, Sharon, and an unacknowledged job status. She seems fairly well off and traditional. And new to Patty's scene is Amber, played by Patty Darbinville, the mother of Rayanne. Amber is a single mom, a radiologic technician who works the evening shift, and goes from being street smart to fragile in short order. This is not the most stable home environment. Each episode unfolds a few storylines across the young people, the core of young people, and another one that features the parents with a certain degree of crossover. So we're talking 15-year-olds here, and of course, parents factor into plots. The parent-youth dynamic is discussed at the ATX Television Festival Season 2 by members of the cast of My So-Called Life.
How the dynamic between your character and Graham was just so true to parents, and a lot of people had very similar relationships with their parents as Angela did. What was that like to play her, and were you anything like her? Were you a little overbearing, or were you more...
That I had two little boys at home, so I loved coming to work where I had all these girls. You know, it was just so sweet. So I think I was actually more overt about being affectionate, physically affectionate with the girls than I ever would have been if I had already experienced teenagers at home. I would have been terrified to actually put my arm around them and kiss them and hug them if I had known how hostile teenagers were. So that created an interesting dynamic, and it's a lot. But I actually look back on that show and think, you don't see many shows, I don't think, nowadays where the parents are given, the adults are given equal weight to the kids, and I think that was one of the things that I hear over the years that people of all ages still find so powerful, that the stories, I mean, you know, Claire has a zit, I find my first wrinkle. That episode, I mean, that was just a wonderful thing. And the kids were discussing Kafka, Metamorphosis in school in the same episode.
I love when people have watched, were fans of the show as kids, you know, as teenagers, and now they come up to me and go, I have to tell you, I watch the show now, and I'm... enthralled with the story, the parent storyline. Like now they're like, oh, she wasn't such a bitch. She was like a freaking mom. Like,
but and then that's another thing that I get. I faced off with two kids at a party recently, where one of them said, "Oh my gosh, you were the mom I always wished I had," and the other one is going, "Are you kidding?" And they were arguing between themselves.
Well, it's in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, but again, that's a tribute to the power of the writing that kids today can be saying, or, you know, who have grown up watching the show can suddenly be seeing the truth in the adult story. You know, your ability to write our voices was just as powerful as with the kids.
Because television rarely singles out grown women characters and their responsibilities to teenage girls, My So-Called Life, as what might initially be perceived as a teen drama, is in fact timeless and an intergenerational must-watch. The rest of this podcast will unfold some of those very important coming-of-age lessons and situations that we found ourselves in when we were growing up, or perhaps our children or grandchildren have found themselves in as they have hit their teenage years. With only 19 episodes, it's tempting to examine each one in depth. It really is. They're great. I leave that to you, as the DVD set is widely available and episodes are also accessible online. Instead, we're going to focus on how some of the relationships and windows into life's lessons unfold throughout the series. So think of it this way. Rayanne and Amber, mother-daughter, daughter-mother, represent an opportunity for growth to both Angela and Patty. And sometimes Angela and Patty cause Rayanne and Amber to grow as individuals as well and within their own relationship. Angela seeks out Rayanne's assistance on all sorts of matters, eventually declaring Rayanne to be her best friend. Angela is enchanted by Amber's loose approach to parenting, her knowledge of tarot cards, and her reasoning that if kids are going to drink, they're going to do it under her roof. Patty sees in Rayanne a ghost of a college roommate who died from reckless choices. Patty initially views Amber's relaxed parenting as irresponsible, but later witnesses that mother-daughter love is not necessarily packaged in oversized sweaters from the Gap. When the show starts, we get the sense that the relationships that Angela and Patty have with the other mother-daughter pair, Sharon and Camille, represent a somewhat stale and predictable status quo. Over time, Angela and Patty grow to find new value in their old friends. Conversations become deeper, much more relevant to trust and instincts and caring about the well-being of the other. It becomes more supportive than competitive. With Angela in the middle, many plots involve competitive tensions between Rayanne and Sharon, as you may recall from your own high school years. Rayanne drinks, even on school property, and Rayanne earns distinction in a gag poll by sophomore boys for being the girl most likely to become a slut. And in that same poll, Sharon is credited with having the biggest boobs. Sharon's traditional upbringing leaves her with even fewer skills to cope with the realities of high school. She's involved in extracurricular activities like the yearbook and begins a relationship with Kyle as her friendship with Angela begins to fade. Patty sees Sharon as a model daughter. In fact, with Sharon's poise, makeup, and wardrobe, Patty may think Sharon is on the path to becoming the popular beauty she was in high school and college. On the other hand, we learn through an exchange with Patty that Camille struggled with her weight throughout high school and college. This is all very real. Even Camille, as the resident conventional mother, has a few moments as the cool mom. On the matter of boys, all three young women can be competitive and judgmental, yet occasionally stand to defend the honor or safety of their friend. Had the final three episodes of season one aired, or had the show continued on to a season two, viewers may well have seen all three become more confident in themselves and supportive of each other. So let's face it, at 15, most emotions and thoughts are raw and scattered. Since teenagers first hit the small screen, we've seen how important clothes, cars, music, and attitudes toward school can be in defining characters. So let's look at these characters. Rayanne blends punk with grunge style, remember it's the mid-90s, and experiments with her hair color and regularly skips class. For Angela, with her figure still a work in progress and a style that emphasizes neutrality over seeking attention. Angela's wardrobe combines tomboy aesthetic with plaid jumpers, tights, and Doc Martens. She skips classes once her real social life picks up, but never embarks on risky behavior with alcohol or drugs. The pilot episode partly focuses on Angela's bold move of dyeing her hair bright red without her mother's permission. And while this might not seem like a strident step of independence, the narrative voice of Claire Danes provides rationale and background to the decision.
How they have it so easy. How you have to pretend you don't notice them noticing you. Like cheerleaders. Can't people just cheer on their own? Like, to themselves?
These writers were smart. never missing a beat to tie in the growth of the mother to the growth of the daughter, which is to say sometimes you just carry the same problems when you're 15 as when you're 40, examining your dreams and progressing toward fulfilling them. Patty gets a dramatic haircut early in episode 2. But in contrast to Angela's experimentation, Sharon's look remains pretty traditional, mostly consisting of a suburban mall style with a hint of feminine sophistication that Angela has yet to acquire. Nearly every episode features a disagreement or consultation in the girls' bathroom between Sharon and Rayanne, and each is smart enough to recognize that the other knows things that they don't, but the competition for Angela's friendship overshadows their progress toward mutual trust, at least in a few episodes. And yes, in case you're wondering, there are men on the show. Graham Chase is Patty's husband and Angela's dad, and he's played by Tom Irwin. And three young men fill out the core group of teens who grow so much during these 19 episodes. Wilson Cruz as Ricky Vasquez, Jared Leto as Jordan Catalano, and Devin Gummersall as Brian Krakow. Each has gone on to further roles in acting, producing, and directing, and they all have established careers. My So-Called Life is great and timeless, though, in part due to the solid acting by the gentlemen named above, as well as Bess Armstrong and Claire Danes. And really, when you look at the entire cast, it's an incredible group. Each is able to deliver solid performances, really, though, consistently because of the well-written scripts and storylines that boldly go where so few dramas have ever gone. The range of identities among characters allows viewers of many different backgrounds to see pieces of themselves on screen in ways that were not always possible on network television and aren't even still today. Assisting young people through the difficult teenage years is a lesson in knowing your own character as much as it is in the development of their characters. And this is an element of adulthood that we all recognize. These very real themes emerge from the first episode of My So-Called Life and continue over time with various characters immersed in the experience, those painful times of growing up. So if you recall any of your own high school years, these themes may sound familiar, and these are the themes that we're going to explore with more clips from the show. Envy and jealousy, betrayal, or the use of another person to advance your own desires, integrity and honesty, realizing your place in the world, and peering into another's life in such a way that it serves to help you value your own. And finally, justice and fairness, and how that helps any person find his or her own voice. And here are a few thoughts from Winnie Holtzman regarding the universal experiences that she projects into each script and storyline.
I remember I really thought to myself, you know, what was it really like and what was going on for me, even though I was a whole generation later, because I don't really believe that people are that different from generation to generation. I believe that people stay, that in our hearts and souls, people stay the same. That one generation, it's just like what Wilson was just saying, one generation isn't that different from another. There's just the outer trappings are different. So I just kind of went within, and that's what came out.
Let's start with envy, which goes hand in hand with jealousy. Envy, we know to be longing to possess or achieve something that another person has. It's a two-part deal, as envy is deployed by one person in relation to another person's situation. In a show filled with love triangles and unrequited and unspoken crushes, jealousy acts as an unfortunate companion to young people as they gain their own confidence and self-esteem. Envy is also at the heart of the girls' interest in each other's living situations. Angela finds Rayanne's house to be filled with laughter, and just the two of them, Rayanne and her mom. Rayanne envies the life Angela lives, a large house, two educated parents who care and earn enough money to take care of Angela's needs. An envy of Angela's situation may just be at the core of Rayanne's 30 days of sobriety when she desires to live up to the higher standards of Angela and Patty. But here's how Rayanne's mom, Amber, describes the girl's relationship to Patty, whom she meets for the first time at school. It's absolutely lyrical.
See it happen. Hey, you know, I really liked what you had to say in there.
Oh, God.
I wish that I could be that.
What, loud? Obnoxious?
Oh. Forceful. I'm Patty Chase.
Hi.
Angela's
Hi.
Mom?
Oh, wow. Angela. Oh, Rayanne talks about her all the time. She's in love with her. She wants to be Angela.
Really? Gosh, they seem so different.
Oh, you know, kids, they find one person and they just can't get enough of them. It's like being in love, only they're not allowed to have sex.
Right.
No, don't you remember? There'd be like this one person who had like perfect hair or perfect breasts, or they were just so funny. And you just wanted to eat them up. Just live in their bed and just be them. It was like everybody else was in black and white and that person was in color. Well, Rayanne thinks Angela is in color. Major color.
So, how is Rayanne handling this whole incident?
Oh, she's great. I'm the basket case.
Angela's just the same.
Who's gonna shoot me with this bod, Ma, she says. They think they're immortal. And they have other things on their mind.
Yes, indeed. Jealousy forms the core of the Rayanne, Angela, and Sharon triangle. And also the core of the Brian, Angela, Jordan triangle. And even the Delia, Brian, Angela triangle. Each character handles his or her jealousy a little bit differently. Sharon's jealousy erupts in direct confrontation with Angela.
Is there any soap in there?
There's never soap.
Hi.
So I just think you should know what people are saying about you.
What?
That you think you're so above everyone, and that Rayanne Graff is like God to you now, and you just do whatever she says. And by the way, she's just using you, like she did with Jodie Barsh. I just thought you should know.
What'd she do to Jodie Barsh?
Oh, please. That's, like, so known. So tell me what I did, Angela. I mean, I would really like to know.
Nothing. It's not something that
you... So you just drop your oldest friend for no reason? I mean, just tell me what I did.
I can't. It's not, like, one thing. It's not like that.
Okay, great. So... just never speak to me again. Real mature, Angela.
No, I want to speak to you. I never
want... No, forget it! God. Your hair. Patty, like hemorrhage? First time she saw it?
In a sense.
Well, I have to say, I hate it.
It's a rare episode that doesn't hit a raw feeling or intense emotion. A bedrock teenage feeling is definitely the one of betrayal. With already highly sensitized feelings and an emerging sense of self within the context of others, these young women encounter betrayal in every episode. Some of that is tied to nobody being able to keep a secret. To keep score through the 19 episodes, a viewer would likely find that Angela, Rayanne, and Sharon are all guilty on this count. Angela feels particularly betrayed in one episode when Rayanne and Jordan have sex in Jordan's car. And that turns out to be a very powerful incident in the whole course of the remaining episodes of the series. And as it turns out, though, on the parallel to the parents, Patty admits to having stolen, albeit briefly, one of Camille's boyfriends back in college. But here's where betrayal between Rayanne and Sharon comes down in the bathroom.
Coming?
Should be there in a minute.
Oh, hold on.
So congratulations, your dream came true.
What dream?
Now you got an ironclad perfect excuse never to talk to me again. You should be celebrating.
You think I'm happy about this? Somebody I care about has been hurt.
You just couldn't wait to go to them with the news.
Don't turn this around on me. I said what I said to protect her.
Protect her? Croc.
That's right. So she would know. Because it's what you do when someone's your friend. You brought this on yourself.
And you're just so happy I did.
No. I'm not.
So in this inventory of teenage behavior, there gets to be that one part that includes being used by another person to advance their own desires. And it's a fault that falls more to Angela than to anyone else. And in doing so, largely unintentionally, Angela gives us a teachable moment regarding our own selfishness. Angela Chase uses her neighbor and longtime friend Brian Krakow in ways that are so painfully obvious, you just want to give her a brief lecture. She uses his possessions, his intellect, and time in pretty much every episode, and he is doggedly loyal. Sharon perceives this early on and attempts to set him straight.
I think that's great.
What?
Like Angela really helped you with your volume meter?
She's planning to. Look, I mean, why would I say it if it wasn't true?
Why would you say she was fainting? Okay, what was that? I mean, some of this actually worked, you know? We don't just expect extra credit because our lab partner's smart. She takes advantage of you, and you totally let her. I pity you.
Sharon, perhaps more than any other character, is the voice of truth and integrity. And she's wise in the ways of people that make her a stabilizing influence for all of the young people around her. Angela, Brian, Ricky, and even Rayanne. Because integrity and truthfulness are key to living in an adult life, it was smart of the show's writers to avoid a subplot around any one of the teen characters fudging the truth. And instead, through Angela's eyes, we witness her father, Graham, having an intense, close contact conversation in the street with another woman. We watch the high school principal attempt to subvert students' freedom of speech when he confiscates the literary magazine. And we watch Patty grow, even in middle age, when handling the IRS audit of the company she took over from her father. She finds out he didn't always act truthfully, and there are questions regarding his claim of expenses during the last year he led the printing firm. So what we learn is that even grown-ups make mistakes and fudge the truth.
The audit. Almost forgot my driving log.
You kept a driving log?
Oh, you see it there, don't you?
Banana cream pie.
Dad, you know, not that you did, but they can tell if...
Patricia, it's perfectly legal. Reconstruction of what happened, best of my ability. I spoke to her.
To the IRS agent? Dad, we agreed that...
She has no objection to us doing this without an accountant.
Well, of course not. She's probably thrilled. They want to trip you up. They have got all sorts of techniques.
Hey, I can handle the IRS. What I can't handle is my own daughter telling me what to do.
So there's no doubt that the parent-child relationship is complex at any age. But Winnie Holtzman does a great job of putting Patty in sort of a clear-thinking role model mode. Her reaction to her father's behavior and his tactics is believable and indeed consistent with her moral standards. And with all these relationships, I believe Holtzman purposely puts them at the fence to peer into the other's world, across the socioeconomic status, across the family status, across the looks and style and confidence differences that exist between all these characters. And from that view, each woman may just appreciate her own situation a bit more. And so we know how they have differed amongst each other, and in many cases been duplicitous to each other. But when given the opportunity to help others through a challenge, do our women of My So-Called Life rise to the occasion? Yes, they do. And in both stark and subtle ways, the writers have provided us insight into their thinking. For instance, one episode focuses on Sharon's father's heart attack. It occurs during a period when Sharon and Angela's friendship is strained. Out of Patty's concern for Sharon's well-being and to lighten the load for her own friend Camille, Patty arranges for Sharon to stay at the Chase's house. After all, Sharon and Angela have been friends forever. But Angela acts awkwardly through the entire event. There's just too much going on socially. And even Rayanne goes out of her way to help Sharon by helping Sharon get a ride to the hospital. But when it's apparent that Sharon's father is out of the woods, Sharon and Angela rediscover the importance of their friendship.
I'm glad your dad's gonna be okay.
My father almost died. And you were the only person who didn't even seem to care. People I barely knew were coming up to me all, like, concerned. And you acted like you barely even knew me.
I know I acted like that. I just didn't know what else to do. I knew I was the last person on Earth you wanted to deal with.
You were the only person I wanted to deal with.
I wanted to talk to you, too. It just seemed like you wanted to help from everyone but me.
I was really scared.
I was, too.
I know we have different friends now, but sometimes I miss you so much.
Me too.
It really hurts.
So if you ask diehard fans of My So-Called Life, what do they remember about the show? They really do remember the coolness of the moms. And Patty Chase rises to the occasion. And so in one of the most memorable scenes in the whole series, and for many, perhaps in TV, a sure finalist for coolest mom on all of TV, and no apologies to Felicia Rashad here because this is a drama, Patty Chase rises to an occasion that could happen to anyone. And if you're a mother, you'll understand this. In episode 10, which is entitled Other People's Mothers, Rayanne's father has sent her money for her birthday. And this is during the period where her drinking has surged, and Rayanne decides that a massive party at the apartment she shares with her mother is in order. Angela, realizing that Rayanne's party conflicts with her grandparents' anniversary party that will be held at the Chase's home, disappoints Patty by choosing to attend Rayanne's. But Rayanne starts drinking early that day and passes out as the apartment is filled with strangers and acquaintances. Angela and Ricky confer, and Angela calls Patty.
Sleep a little.
Get water. Throw it on the face. Rayanne, wake up. You can't sleep.
Stop.
Ricky, I've never seen her like this. I don't know what to do, Angela.
I know what to do.
Okay.
really need you.
Mom.
It's all right. Go.
Tell Graham.
Go.
Okay, I've called an ambulance. How long has she been like this?
You mean how long?
This breathing, this slow breathing.
A while, 15
Graham?
Minutes.
And what did she take?
I don't know. She just kept on drinking.
Okay. A lot of alcohol. What about drugs? I need names.
I know she took ecstasy.
How much?
I don't know. I think just like 2 hits. It looked like she was saving one.
Can you find me the one she was saving? Ricky, can you find me the one she was saving? Get me a blanket. Oh, she's waking up. Rayanne! Rayanne!
I like you.
This is Jack. Jack.
She's had a lot of alcohol and some ecstasy. 2 hits or whatever you call them here. I've got the third one right here.
Good.
It took 9 episodes for Patty to transform from a fairly self-centered, middle-aged woman to one who recognizes that her daughter has a circle of decent friends who are human, and they're teenagers, and they're growing. So her transformation comes from reflecting on her own teen and college years, and while viewers also get to see her marriage to Graham through Patty's eyes, you get the sense that Patty is stronger for having taken stock in her own value. Like so many parents, Patty walks the fine line of getting too involved in the problems and issues her daughter's friends are experiencing, and she's evolved to a point of welcoming them and understanding that they come from homes of lesser means and attention than what she and Graham have been able to provide for Angela and Angela's sister, Danielle. Which brings us to episode 14, entitled Grace of God. And it's a Christmas-themed show, and it's probably one of the most memorable Christmas episodes I've ever seen. As the family readies the house for Christmas, Patty announces it would be nice for them to go to church. This is an important moral benchmark for the plot unfolds to bring the major characters to a better understanding of faith, hope, and charity. And lo and behold, at the end of the episode, they do find themselves in church. Christmas Eve shows Sharon and Rayanne working a teen hotline shift and finding new things in common and new strengths each other finds admirable. And among other things, they're finding common ground and they're finding mutual respect. And so it's a very warm moment. But by Christmas Eve, Ricky's homelessness is approaching crisis stage. And the school counselor has Ricky on a shelter wait list that is a month long. Now, teen homelessness has only gotten worse in the 20 years since My So-Called Life has aired. So as I continue to say that some of these plots are timeless, they're actually only growing more profound and watchable and relatable. Ricky's English teacher, who we discover is gay, is also very concerned about Ricky's well-being. And Patty and Angela have a fight. It's Christmas Eve. They have a fight when Angela realizes Ricky is out on the streets, likely staying in an abandoned warehouse. Patty is concerned for Angela's well-being, so she goes off in search of Angela, who has stormed out the door. Now remember, this all took place before everyone had a phone in their pocket, and you couldn't just text and stay in touch. And while Patty is out searching for Angela, she encounters a teenager about the same age as Angela who happens to be wearing shoes that look a lot like Angela's. And yet she begins to realize that this teen is a ghost and a message regarding the blessings of life.
I'm sorry. My daughter has boots just like those. You see, I'm trying to find my daughter, and
I know, because I'm no different from her.
No, you don't understand. understand.
Sure I do. I had a mom. Clean sheets, all of that. Another toss of the dice. I could be in her shoes. She could be in mine.
There, but for the grace of God.
Go I. Go ahead. Ask me.
Why did you leave home?
My mother and I had a fight. The kind of fight where it seems like the fight is having you. So what else do you want to know?
How did you die?
I froze.
The episode ends with the Chase family in a church, along with Ricky, who seems incredibly grateful that he's been found. And Ricky regularly wears a crucifix and has said in previous episodes that he thinks of himself as a Catholic. So finally, as it happens for many teenagers, it is through Angela's continued search for justice and fairness that she begins to gain confidence. Her voice as narrator becomes stronger and holds more conviction than it does early in the series. And it's this progress, so worthy of discussion and celebration, that makes the show's cancellation all the more tragic. I mean, really, wrestling with justice and fairness is part and parcel of the American teen experience. And My So-Called Life does a tremendous job of presenting so many different ethical and moral situations that make us better people for having watched it, and perhaps better parents. Because many of the plots revolve around school and academic activities, we get the sense that Angela is an above-average student when she applies herself. A substitute teacher captivates her attention and opens her eyes beyond the realm of Liberty High. She responds with a whole heart, and in the process, Patty is forced to flash back to her own coming of age in the 60s and how important she thought it was to speak out and stand up for what she believed in. The school's principal has confiscated the student literary magazine, which is printed by Patty's printing company, all because one poem is sexually suggestive. Angela recognizes this restriction as censorship and uses her new appreciation of self-expression and art gained from the substitute teacher. After the printed magazines have disappeared, been confiscated by the principal, Angela keeps fighting the fight by producing copies on the school copy machine. She gets called into the principal's office.
Yes, here we are.
Can I
Oh, no, they called you? Of course they called us.
I can see that you really took what we talked about the other day to heart.
I did.
Do you know what this means? This will go on your record.
I want it to go on my record.
You want it to?
Okay, let's just stay home. We're in the principal's office here.
I mean, what is the point of school if you can't say what you're thinking?
Do you have to be the personal spokesperson for the entire school?
You told me to pick my battles. Well, this is it. And it may not be a war protest or a civil rights demonstration, but it's all I've got. Well, that's not completely true. There are a couple of truths. You said I needed to decide what to fight for. I decided. I just think it's wrong to censor people, and I'm willing to get suspended for it.
My So-Called Life will long be remembered for not sugarcoating the many ethical and moral questions it presents. And so in that sense, the show is nearly timeless. And there aren't many distractions or deviations from that incredible growth curve set for each major character. they change immensely over the 19 episodes. And much of that is due to the experience of writer and producer Winnie Holtzman. Holtzman had previously worked on the TV show 30-something, which also was a production of Marshall, Herskovitz, and Ed Zwick. They all went on to work, too, on Once and Again, which starred Celia Ward, a great show. Wikipedia paints Holtzman's road to Hollywood as one of poet, sketch comic, and musical theater writer. And in a 2014 interview for Vulture Online magazine about My So-Called Life's Plot Lines, Holtzman said this: "Series television is kind of intensive in terms of time. You fall hard for TV writing, but it's almost a love-hate. You're under pressure all the time, but that pressure gets interesting things out of you that are, you know, mysterious. The whole idea of a dream, to me, is a mystery plane. Things are operating there that tell us the real truth. The stuff going on inside us that we don't express or even know about pours out in our dreams. In a funny way, it was a way for me to instantly get to a deeper psychological place." And so she was specifically referencing an episode that included revelations of dreams by the major teen characters. And these three dramas, 30-something, My So-Called Life, and Once and Again, are highly regarded for their thoughtful approaches to real-life situations. And Holtzman is squarely the architect. She's delivered this groundbreaking show that brought real teen issues to life with respect and dignity. And she spoke openly at the 2013 ATX Television Festival about teamwork and support that went into the show.
Thank you all for enjoying it. I think you really don't do something like that all by yourself. Even though I wrote it, I had just met these two remarkable guys, Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskovitz, and they had inspired me by what they were writing for TV. You know, you really can't separate yourself from all the people you meet along the way who inspire you. You know, I think about my writing teachers who said to me, you know, you can do this. I mean, you don't just sit down and do something by yourself. It really is something where people are all connected. We all were operating, you know, kind of as a force field. We were all doing something together. And I was inspired by the cast. The cast was getting inspired by what I was writing. But I think just in my personal case, I just want to acknowledge that I couldn't have done anything if people, certain key people, hadn't come into my life and said, you can do it, and we want you to do it, and we care about what you have to say.
Advanced TV Herstory holds this show and all the people associated with it in very high regard. Unfortunately, for all sorts of reasons, it lasted only 19 of the first season's 22 episodes. It was canceled without fanfare, mid-story arc, some would say. MTV news coverage of the campaign to save My So-Called Life is available online in a video archive. In it, a young Claire Dane speaks to the show's risk-taking and honesty. And in other interviews, both Danes and Holtzman assert that maybe it was all just too real to attract the significant audience size a TV show needs to sustain itself. It was deep. It was thoughtful. Advanced TV Herstory wants to posit one more reason for the show's abrupt cancellation in 1995. And that is to say, abrupt cancellation 3 episodes short of a complete season. In that last episode, viewers followed the ongoing romantic entanglements of Jordan and Angela, Graham and Hallie, that was more of a flirtation, and Brian and his feelings for Angela, and we were even introduced to a new one with recurring minor character Delia Fisher revealing her feelings of friendship for Ricky.
Delia? Maybe we should, go somewhere sometime.
Okay.
You know, like, to a movie or something.
I'd like that.
Because, I really think we'd be good together.
Okay. But, you're gay, right?
Well, I...
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't...
No, it's okay.
That came out so rude.
No, see, I try not to, I don't like, Yeah. I'm gay.
I just don't usually say it like that.
How do you usually say it?
I don't usually say it. I mean, I've actually never said it out loud.
Wow.
In 1995, that was still a pretty big statement on primetime network TV, especially to be made by a person under the age of 18. Just 2 years earlier, Congress had called for an investigation of PBS over its airing of an adaptation of Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City, which featured a gay character. Gay characters, mostly adult men, had been shown in more comedies than dramas over the last few decades. But in 1995, I have to wonder if, between the network execs and irate sponsors, the idea of a Puerto Rican teenage boy declaring he's gay was just too much. And such declaration from a character who regularly worships in the Catholic Church and wears a crucifix, as we learned in the first 18 episodes, would only lead to more complex and controversial storylines. I mean, let's think about this. Would these storylines include Ricky's temporary stay with the gay English teacher and his partner? It all gets very complicated. So, Advanced TV Herstory has researched extensively and not been able to answer this question. Did Winnie Holtzman know this was truly the last segment and put all her eggs of controversy, namely that of Ricky's sexual preference, into that one final basket? Or was Holtzman plodding along, thinking she had three more episodes in which she could bring closure to the many storylines, but the content of episode 19 brought it all to an abrupt halt? Since there's no evidence pointing in any direction, Advanced TV Herstory appreciates Winnie Holtzman for her profound capacity to tell a story and to tell it like it is through the eyes of women. We applaud her leading the team right up to the brink of a breakthrough moment in TV. Everyone associated with the show has stuck to the talking points of low ratings and intense storylines. But producers Herskovitz and Zwick were established commodities, and this was another example of their quality work. It just seems so odd. The show ends with 1,000 questions and open story arcs all over the place. Kind of fitting, given the jaded narration of teenage Claire Danes.
It just seems like you agreed to have a certain personality or something. For no reason. Just to make things easier for everyone. But when you think about it, I mean, how do you know if it's even you? And I mean, this whole thing with yearbook, it's like everybody's in this big hurry to make this book. To supposedly remember what happened, but it's not even what really happened, it's what everybody thinks was supposed to happen. Because if you made a book of what really happened, it'd be a really upsetting book. You know, in my humble opinion.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Advanced TV Herstory. All 19 episodes of My So-Called Life can be found on Hulu and DVD. Background music you've heard on this episode can be found at freemusicarchive.org. Audio clips of the actors and Winnie Holtzman were pulled from 2013 interviews that were from the ATX Television Festival Season 2 and also a Paley Center interview from 2008. And finally, I am grateful for the editing and content assistance from Molly Henderson, a senior at Northwestern University, majoring in American Studies and Urban Studies. We might just as well say that she's worthy of a minor in My So-Called Life as well. I appreciate all she's contributed to this script and this show. I'm your host, Cynthia Bemis Abrams. Thanks for listening. If you're listening to this podcast through an iTunes download, please go back to iTunes and rate and review this podcast or any of the other episodes of Advanced TV Herstory. Thank you.